speaking for the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. May I present you with this award, you as the Commander-in-Chief of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and Mr. Strumberg, your producer, Mr. Leonard, your director, for the best picture of the year, The Great Ziegfeld.
Mr. Jessel, I thank you on behalf of my organization that I'm proud to be the head of, that has such men as Strumberg, producer, Leonard, director, and the artists that made possible the picture that was chosen as the best picture for the year. Proud to be the head of a studio that has five pictures this year competing for honors.
What's so stupid?
Okay, guys, welcome to Awards Don't Matter. This is a show where we ask about the Academy Awards and we say, does this Best Picture Oscar winner matter or not? My name is Andrew and I'm joined by Dave, my co-host, to discuss
Dave
these
is films. Here under duress.
Yeah, Dave, you can't see, but duress. he is holding up a sign that says SOS, help me. We are going to be discussing the ninth Best Picture winner, The Great Ziegfeld, starring William Powell as The Great Ziegfeld. Dave, because I love you so much, do you want to tell me what the plot of this film is?
No, Andrew, we were doing so well. We had like two episodes in a row where I didn't hate you. I just, it's essentially about this guy who's like, you know, trying to run this sideshow and nothing's working. And I don't know. It's a bunch of fucking bullshit. It's fucking terrible. I'm sorry. It's just a bad movie. Like, and it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be such a bad movie because, like, it's got a great cast full of charming people. It's big and it's bold and it's brash and it should be fun. And in the short history of our show, I have never been so fucking bored as when I was watching this movie. Like, there are things in it that are upsetting, but like, it couldn't even like drag me out of my stupor to give a shit. Like, you get past the first 20 minutes of this movie and it is all terrible. Like, there is one scene early in the movie where you have William Powell flirting with a woman. And that little like 2 minute scene is probably the best thing in the movie. The rest of it is so, so bad. And that's before blackface shows up for no reason. Like, it's just like they use blackface as the, like, you know, the changing of the set. Like, oh, there's the guy in blackface again. I'm like, oh God, why? Stop it. There's no reason for this. And actually, for some background, I just watched recently Bamboozled, the Spike Lee movie. So now anytime blackface is used, I'm especially affected by it and kind of disgusted by it. So this part of this is just bad timing. But like, man, it is rough. Like, it's a difficult movie to talk about because even the bad parts aren't bad enough for you to care and to really like tease apart why it's bad. It's just like, and then a thing happened. Like, this is maybe only the second or third time in our show where I'm like, what were people thinking? I don't get it. I don't understand. I don't understand why anyone would see this more than once. I don't understand why it would win Oscars. And like, this is a movie with Powell and Loy. Like, William Powell and Myrna Loy. Like, two of the most charming actors of their generation. And one, she doesn't show up until there's like 20 minutes left in the movie. And it's long. It's like a 3-hour movie. So it's like, and she just shows up and they like, you know, fall in love, I guess, and get married for like no reason. Like, they don't even let the two of them play much. Like, you get in something like The Thin Man in all of its 900 sequels, which are all the same and all wonderful. And this is just like, this is really the first time, Andrew, that this show felt like homework. Like, I watched this in, I think, 4 segments because I was just like, I got to do something else. Like, this, not even like, because sometimes a movie is good, but like exhausting, right? Like, in our last episode, I mentioned Schindler's List. I can understand taking a break from that. There's a lot of rough stuff in there. You're like, I just need to know that the sun is shining somewhere and do something. But this is not that movie. This is just like, oh God. And there's no narrative to this movie, really. It's just like they wanted to show just how much money they could spend on big dance numbers that are boring to look at. Like, just a lot of feathers That's what we get from the Great Ziegfeld, is a great amount of feathers and nothing else. God, this movie sucks. I'm so angry at this movie, and you, in particular, for convincing me to do this stupid show that I had to watch this. God, it was rough.
Well, at the time, this was considered it was the longest film in existence, which that in itself...
It still feels like the longest movie in existence.
Yeah. But I wanna touch on, like, you ask why this particular film would resonate with audiences and why it would succeed and be a major success.
Yes,
and it was the biggest film of that year. It was a huge success. And, you know, I wonder about these kinds of films because I would never have known about Ziegfeld or a lot of the events that are in this particular film, if it weren't for The Great Ziegfeld. Because, you know, when we're talking about the Follies and the reviews, the dancing reviews and the theatrical reviews and stuff like that off the era, we have no archival, well, not no, but we have very precious little archival history off that particular time. There's precious little footage, there's precious little... you know, recordings of what went on in that particular period of time. And yet this particular film carries a lot of the trademarks of that stage bound era. It even has people in there who is Fanny Bryce is actually in this particular film, and she was an icon of that time. And it's great that she's given the chance to actually... We have a recording of her singing. We have a recording of her stage presence. And I think that in itself is valuable and important. And I'm glad that this kind of narrative is captured on film, that this kind of person, his history is captured on film, because, yes, it is an important part of history. But documentation doesn't equal quality. And recording of what has gone on does not equal quality. And it's clear throughout this particular film that the landmarks of what was considered right and accepted in the time is not accepted or, you know, warranted or even worthwhile celebrating at all nowadays. Like, one of the main things and the main trademarks of who Ziegfeld is as a person is that he continually goes around negging people. And, you know, basically that's how he flirts and that's how he gets his business done. And it's like, you're good, but maybe you should take this part of your dress off and maybe you should just not look so ugly. And it's like, far out, man, just settle down. And when it's coming from, you know, an actor like William
Powell. I did have that thought as I was watching it. Like, is this the first negging on screen? Like, it felt... disgustingly modern. Like, I was just like, oh god, I don't like this. And I like him so much as an actor that I let a fair amount of it slide. And I thought, like, maybe that's just his way of flirting in the beginning and he's gonna get better, and he just doesn't. Like, he just continues it. Like, I was just like, oh, I don't not a fan of this. And like, didn't one of the actresses in here get nominated for best actor too? The one with the French girl. Right?
She won. She won Best Actress.
And so, Miss Reiner, we present you with this award for the finest acting during the year of 1936 in the picture The Great Ziegfeld.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy that I got it.
That is Louise Rainer playing Anna Held. And look, we talk about performances that go to the back row. This is I heard this in Australia and I wasn't even alive at the time, you know. That's how like that's how big this film is. It is a performance and a half, and you know, she beat out some other actresses who I haven't seen the performances that they gave, but I'm sure that they'll be much better than this. It's just a debacle. It really is. You know, we talk about in the last episode, I mentioned about how maybe they should give the awards a year or two after the films actually took place. And I really think that they should have just gone, top hat, you know, we failed you last year. Here is an award this right. year. We're going to give you the best picture this year because we fucked up last year. Because this is a mess. It's an absolute mess. And look, I've written a whole bunch of notes about this film. I've written far too many notes about it because it's a horrible film. But I do kind of... I don't even want to touch on any of these. you know, but one of the questions I do have is that how was Myrna Loy never nominated for an Oscar? Like, for The Thin Man, she was never nominated, and for anything else, she was never nominated. And she's the only... She is in the last 20 minutes of this film, but she's one of the few redeeming qualities of it. How was she never nominated?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think... One thing separate from that is I noticed it lost probably the only award it should have won, which was Best Art Direction, because it's you know, it's beautiful to look at. I mean, it's got a lot of redeeming qualities, just the film itself. But Myrna Loy, I think, is probably a victim of, like, you know, there's not that many actors or actresses that, like, have that much charm that tend to get rewarded. It's got to be big, and but like, she doesn't give big performances, actually, especially for being a comedic actress. Mostly she's very subtle, and she lets her co-star have the shine. Like, she lets William Powell really have the fun, and she just kind of reacts, and she does her little bits, and she's actually for the time a tremendously modern actress. And I don't think that's what they were looking for. You know, they're looking for, and God love her for this, they're looking for Bette Davis. Like, let me go big. Let me go as big as possible, and let me get rewarded for that. I think Myrna Loy actually would be much much better served if she had been born 40 years later. Like, she would have been a mega star, because obviously beautiful and stunning and all that. But, like, just from an actorly perspective, like, she wasn't doing what the Academy wanted in the 1930s and 1940s. You know, like, even actors like Katharine Hepburn. Who's wonderful in a lot of things, is she makes big stylistic choices. She has a shtick. She's Kate. She does her Kate thing. And Myrna Loy didn't do that. She didn't have really a shtick. She let the work speak for itself. She let her scene partners speak for themselves, and she worked with them. And I think that's probably, I mean, Frank, it's sad, but I think that's kind of still true now in a lot of ways. Like, there's a lot of actors who do really subtle work that don't get rewarded. I mean, even if you look at Daniel Day-Lewis, who I love, he goes big in a lot of his performances, and he kind of always has. He does noticeable great work, but noticeable work nonetheless. And, you know, there are, you know, actresses like, you know, I just saw a movie recently this year called Blow the Man Down, and Margot Martindale is in it. She has a supporting role. And, like, for my money, it's the best performance of the year. Of course, she's getting not a sniff of any awards thought, because, like, you know, it's not big. It's not bold. It's not noticeable. You know, and films like, we've talked about this, but films like First Cow is getting probably no Oscar love this year. And it's one of the best movies of the year. And it's not getting that love because it's subtle, and it's not going to bring people in. It's going to bring in cinephiles, but, like, a normal person, they're like, I'm not watching that nonsense.
Yeah.
Like, a film about a friendship in the old West, making cake. I'm not interested in that. So yeah, I think Myrna Loy is just kind of, you know, she's too good for this world, and certainly too good for the Oscars. I know it's shitty to say at an Oscars show, but, you know, the Oscars don't always get it right.
Oh, they're never going to recover from that burn, Dave.
I know you heard me.
In my notes, I have written down, this is as good a segue as I can have. In my notes, I have written down a line of dialogue. I have no idea what it's in reference to, but a line of dialogue from this film is, I do not have to be a cow to be a success. And it's like, well, you know, bless cows. Cows are great. They do a lot of they do a lot for us, and we treat them poorly. You know, but this film is a cow for film. It's a terrible film. But I want to touch on one of the things that takes place. So I've written, right. So the last we heard before the intermission, because people, there is a 5-minute overture for this film. There is a 5-minute intermission. There is a 5-minute closing music outro to this film too. So, you know, at least you know where your bookmarked toilet breaks are if you must endure this film. But I've written, right, so last we heard before the intermission was that Ziegfeld was broke as fuck. And now, after the intermission, he flops out the biggest, most elaborate and expensive show because of, well, who the fuck knows?
Now, because reasons.
Because reasons. Yeah, he's constantly borrowing and stealing money from his close friend, who is like, oh, yeah, no worries, mate. And they have this kind of sparring relationship with each other that there's like, yeah, it's probably good that Ziegfeld is around, and so I'm going to finance his success because he does good quality stuff. But the main showcase point of this film, and it goes on for quite a period of time to the point where I was like, is the last half of this film literally just going to be one of his performances?
Heavenly Rhapsody, she catches you right from the start. Just like a beautiful melody, she'll play on the strings of your heart.
A pretty girl is like a melody.
But it is this massive, grand performance of this musical sequence. And it was huge. It's like this huge kind of cake of a scene, which I think it was like 70 foot high thereabouts. This basically unfurling off this staircase where there is countless dancers and musicians and things like that. Yeah, 70 foot in diameter with 175 spiral steps weighing 100 tons. And it's this, yeah, it's this massive moment where A Pretty Girl is Like a Melody, which is, it won the Academy Award for Best Dance Direction. And it is a show-stopping moment. It is a pretty impressive moment. And they try to inject this sequence with a whole bunch of Busby Berkeley-esque dance sequences, which fail completely. But one of the enduring aspects of this film that I think has kind of become atypical with the modern Oscars is that I watched this and it felt like you could put this on at this year's Oscars and it wouldn't feel out of place. It felt like an Oscar ceremony right there and then. And I know that that's not what the Oscar ceremonies were like then, but it's what they feel like now. Did you get that impression at all?
Well, a couple things. One, I think as I've mentioned on the show before, I am a big fan of musicals, but I am not a big fan of this musical. Holy crap. Like, show-stopping, yeah, I guess. Like, it becomes repetitive. It's overlong. It's not, the music itself isn't engaging enough. Like, I just was like, this would have been a great moment had it been but a moment. But it was much longer than a moment. This is like you said, it feels like it's never going to end. It feels like this is just going to keep going and then the credits are going to roll and they forgot about the narrative because they forgot about the rest of the movie. Why not? Let's just wrap it up. And I kind of wish that's what they had done. But you're right. It looks like Oscars now in the sense of like this looks like a mockery of what the Oscars are, of what these big events are. And I don't think that's what they were going for. This looks like one of those moments because Oscars usually, as their hosts, they usually have a comedian, right? So this is the moment in the Oscars where the comedian comes out and gets hit with feathers or gets kicked in the chin by a rocket or something. Like, that's what it reminds me of. So it's just a mockery of itself. It's just ridiculous. And there's no point. There's no point to this. We know he's a director. Like, and that is literally all that this is giving us, is that he directed a show. Like, we could accomplish this in about 12 seconds of being like, look at all the money coming in. We're doing really well. Done. And maybe have like a 2-minute sequence that shows off a little bit. But it was almost like they had a bunch of extra money and were like, what do we do? I guess do a sing and dance. And it's like it was hard for me to sit through. And again, I love big song and dance numbers. I love them. And I got to be honest with you, Andrew. The scene started and I was with it for a little while and then I started to fade off and I think I like looked at my phone and then I came back and it's still going on. I was like, how is this still happening? Like, I don't know how long it was. You could tell me that scene lasted an hour and 15 minutes and I believe you. Oh my God, just stop it. There's no reason for, especially because this is not a musical like we think of Broadway musicals, right? Where it's like people are singing and dancing their lives right? That would be different because that's like a consistent thing. This is a musical with certain numbers, right? And now we're going to do a song. There is no reason on God's green earth that you should have a 30-minute song and dance number. Even as long as this movie is, that's a sixth of the movie.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Cut it.
I think that comes back to the thing of like, this was what was going on at the time in the late 1800s, early
1900s. That's not my fault, Andrew.
I know it's not your fault. I know. But it lends itself to an archival element, which is more of a curio that you should walk past in a museum and go, oh, that's nice. And then you move on to something that's more interesting. And one of the things...
You should run past it as quickly as you can. Just run. Run.
But it makes me wonder, like, were these follies ever entertaining? Like, were they ever interesting? Probably not. But one of the things which near the end of it, and we never get to see it as such, but one of the final things that Ziegfeld wants to do is create... He's like... I have this novel idea. Why don't I do what I'm currently doing, but with a plot? And it's like, that sounds like a great idea, mate. You should have done that from the get-go.
Should have done it 2 hours and 45 minutes ago. That would have been great.
And there is an aspect of me that feels bad for bashing what was the norm in the day because they didn't know any better. But on the same hand, like, blackface existed, racism existed, inequality existed. You couldn't be openly gay. You couldn't, you know, there was so much that was wrong back then that we can't just go, well, it was wrong now and it was wrong back then, but they didn't know any better, so therefore they get a pass. No, they don't get a pass. You don't get a pass at all. Injustice has existed, and I'm not saying that this is on the level of slavery or racism or, you know, homophobia or anything like that. But it is a slight on cinema, and that is what we're focused on, and it's a piece of shit. And there's a sequel. There's a sequel as well, by the way.
No.
Right. So you're going to love this. Okay, so there's a sequel called Ziegfeld Follies, which was made a couple of years later. William Powell is in it, and for those who have sat through this film, Ziegfeld is dead at the end of this movie. So how can there be a sequel? Right? How can there be a sequel?
Tell me how.
Ziegfeld Follies, the plot of that is Ziegfeld produces a play from heaven.
Oh, son of a bitch. God damn it. Like, I knew it was going to be stupid, but...
So he's dead, and they like, that guy was pretty good. Let's just make up a story
like
where...
Is it like a play for, like, people in heaven to watch? Like,
No. He returns to Earth and makes a play from heaven.
God damn it. You have done the impossible, Andrew. You've somehow made this be worse. Like, looking back, it makes it even worse that it spawned a sequel with that stupid of an idea. Oh, my God. Like, Andrew, I don't think there's any movie so far, except this one that we've covered, that I outright will refuse to ever watch again. Like, I just can't. And I think, honestly, it's not... I don't even think it's the worst one we've watched. It's very bad. It's probably bottom two. But the only reason it ekes out above anything else is because Powell and Loy are so charming together. And you get just a little bit of that. You get a little bit of that near the end, and you're just like, yeah, those are the two I want to watch. But 20 minutes out of 180, that's rough. That's not a lot to hold on to. And it's just, I mean, maybe the most joyful part of this, like, hey, it's the wizard from Wizard of Oz. That's it. That's like the biggest like smile I got from this movie. Like, oh, I recognize that voice. That's it. The rest of it is just like so, it's almost impressive how tedious this movie is. It's about big shows and big dance numbers and, you know, dramatic actresses. Like, this should be, even if it's bad, it should be fun. Even if it's ridiculous, it should be enjoyable. And there's, like, none of that. Like, all the sequences with, you know, like, him bringing in the press, the milk baths and all that, that stuff should be really funny and really enjoyable. But I'm just like, I would like all of you to stop talking. Like, I don't want I don't want to be here anymore, and I won't want you to be here anymore. Get off my screen. But I'm watching this for a podcast for Andrew, so I have to keep watching this. Like, I don't know if I hadn't been assigned this, like, homework, I don't know if I would have finished it. I might have just left it on in the background.
I nearly turned it off.
I almost tapped out
as well. Yeah.
Yeah. It's rough. It's rough.
But this, the sad thing is as well, I think that... you know, this is, what year is it? 1937. So things are starting to heat up and get bad in the world. In 2 years, World War II will erupt, which is going to be interesting to see how the filmic choice that wins then, how that reflects the era as well. We know what that is, Gone with the Wind. But looking at the list of nominees for this year, it was a pretty weak year. And while usually we would do an extra episode, and this kind of film does kind of... almost required to have a discussion about something else to say, look, this should have won. But the films that were nominated alongside this, you know, I've only seen one of them, which was Dodsworth, which was the first William Wyler film, who we will talk about a lot more in the future because he is one of the most deserving and highly rewarded directors for the Oscars, at the Oscars. Dodsworth is a good film. But I couldn't say that it's worthwhile winning Best Picture. Like, it's a good drama. It's a really, really good drama. And that's about it. Did you watch many of the other films nominated?
Not many. I've seen The Romeo and Juliet, which was very good, but of course pretty, you know, prestige-y, which is not a big surprise. But I am stuck on the fact that My Man Godfrey, which is a wonderful screwball comedy, also came out that year, got nominated for Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and no Best Supporting Actress as well, and yet no Best Picture nomination. Also, with Powell in it, they just nominated the wrong movie with him in it. Like, just come on, what are we doing? Like, that is probably out of all the, like, nominees for all these movies, other than, like, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, which is known. I think My Man Godfrey is probably the one that has the longest kind of shelf life and people still think highly of. And what a better world we'd live in if Andrew had made me watch My Man Godfrey instead of the goddamn Great Ziegfeld. God damn it. Stupid Oscars. What are you doing to me? Just a poor, poor choice. This is rough. You're right, though. It is a relatively weak year in terms of, like, you know, you go down the list, and usually if you're like a big film buff, even if you haven't seen the movies, you can go down the list of Oscar-nominated movies and be like, oh, I've heard of most of those, right? Not so much the case in this year. There's a lot of kind of forgotten-by-time movies, and who knows if they should have been or shouldn't. I can't make that call because I didn't watch a bunch of them like I usually do, because Andrew was like, no, we're going to record now. And I was like, fine, Andrew. That's a fucking Great Ziegfeld. I just want to get this out of my system. But yeah, there's still, even in a weak year, there are choices. And Oscars, you made a poor, poor choice, and I am suffering because of it. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Academy.
Decades on, worst. They didn't think of you, and that's a real shame. So yeah.
Yeah, they really should have. I agree.
But that's it. That's it. That's what it comes down to, is that a lot of these films, they don't think of the historical relevance or the historical importance. And maybe they thought that the life of Ziegfeld was important to restore and catalog as a historical aspect. I disagree. But it comes down to the decision-making that the Oscars make. And while there is a completely different voting body now as there was back then, you can't help but wonder how they decide how they're going to vote and why they think that this particular film is most important to retain as a historical aspect, historical document, I guess.
Drunk, Andrew. They were drunk.
They were drunk. Only... but there's also a case of, like, you know, while they vote for something like this, it's clear that they're not thinking of what it's going to mean in decades to come, what it's going to say about the time or anything like that. And that happens time and time again. There are rare times where they actually get the right thing, and which we find as we go along. This film doesn't matter. It never mattered. It's unimportant. It's a waste of time.
Oh. I'm surprised that you say that, because you went on and on about paying price. Oh, God, we got to have the documentation. We'll go put it in a museum so we can walk by it. Like, blah, blah, blah. But I'm glad that you agree that this movie doesn't matter and the world is a better place if you never watch it. Don't watch The Great Ziegfeld. Watch literally anything else.
Yeah. There you go. So there you go. That's The Great Ziegfeld. Next episode, we're going to be talking about a film that I know absolutely nothing about, but The Life of Emile Zola. But we're heading into, like, I am getting a little bit excited now, Dave. I must tell you, I'm getting a little bit excited.
Oh, no. Time to cancel the show. Can't have you happy. I don't want it.
Because
okay, why are you getting excited?
Well, we're heading into some pretty impressive winners. You know, I'm very excited to watch You Can't Take It With You. I hear really good things about that. I'm quite deficient in having seen Frank Capra's films, so I'm glad for that opportunity. But then we head into films like Gone with the Wind, which I'm really looking forward to that discussion, because I know there is a lot to talk about with that particular film, but I'm curious to see, like, I only watched it for the first time not so long ago, and I'm curious to see how the modern perspective is on that particular film. And then heading forwards to films like Rebecca, you know, I've not seen that and I'm excited to see that. I know Dave is falling asleep on the screen right now, so
I just, like, it still wows me. So like and everyone has these movies, right? Like, some of the movies you haven't seen, like, blow my mind. Like, I was like, you haven't seen Rebecca? Like, that feels like a movie that you would have seen by now. Like, not in a way of, like, you idiot, how could you not have watched this? But it feels like up your alley. Like, it feels like a movie you would have seen and liked. So I'm interested to see how that goes. I'm also interested to see how Gone with the Wind goes, because I don't think I've seen that in 20 years. Like, it's been a long time since I've watched that. It was one of my dad's favorites, but, like, you know, and I liked it when I was younger, but, like, I think I'm a little bit more, let's say, socially aware now than I was then. So it'll be interesting to rewatch those. All I know is next episode, Life of Emile Zola, better be good, because some of the other nominees are really, really good. So
there's a lot of
better,
great stuff.
It better live up.
Yeah. So yeah, that's it. That's The Great Ziegfeld. That's us. Where can we find you, Dave, on social media?
You can find me on Twitter at DarnThatDave, and you can listen to my other podcast, Off Screen Death, and follow us on Twitter at Off Screen Death.
And you can find us, Awards Don't Matter, on all the social medias, and you can find me at The Curb AU on both Facebook and on Twitter for all things not this.